Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dennis Halliday, former Undersecretary General at the United Nations and coordinator of Iraq's Oil for Food program, who examines the obstacles ahead for Baghdad's newly appointed interim government. Hannah Sassaman of the Prometheus Radio Project, who discusses a recent court victory for community media where proposed FCC deregulation rules were overturned. And Steve Rendell, senior analyst with the Media Watch Group, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who takes a look at the reasons behind the phenomenal success of Michael Moore's new documentary, Fahrenheit 9/11. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that agents for the Department of Homeland Security have conducted new sweeps looking for undocumented immigrants and have in the process interviewed at least 20,000 people. Since March, advocates for immigrants have received reports of aggressive new tactics by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a division of the Department of Homeland Security, such as agents questioning people randomly about their legal status in housing projects and on buses. In Houston, Texas, rumors of mass immigration raids drove the local Latino community into a panic. As Arnaldo Garcia of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights observed, they stopped sending their kids to schools, stopped attending church, and stopped going to work. In San Francisco, public officials have protested the new tactics by immigration agents. Board of Supervisors member Chris Daly introduced a resolution calling for the FBI and Department of Homeland Security to stop targeting hardworking immigrants. The resolution calls for giving undocumented workers access to a lawyer when detained and the right to a public hearing. In San Diego, federal agents are asking people about their immigration status on public transportation, which has resulted in over 200 arrests. In one case, Border Control agents questioned a 16-year-old schoolgirl on her way to a charter school, but the agents did not accept her school ID as valid identification. They further questioned the teenager about where she lives and wanted to go to her school to verify her immigration status. Fearful of further interrogation, the teenager has stopped going to school. Human rights groups are hailing a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on June 30th that affirms the standing of the 1789 Alien Tort Claims Act that allows non-U.S. citizens access to U.S. courts as victims of torture and genocide abroad. The case, Sosa v. Alvarez Machain, examined the short-term arbitrary detention of a Mexican national who was acquitted of killing a federal drug enforcement agent in 1992. Although the Supreme Court voted 6-3 against an appeals court decision that would have allowed Alvarez to file a claim under the tort law, the law itself stands intact. Over the past few months, the case won wide attention because human rights lawyers have used the law to file cases against major corporations like Unocal and ExxonMobil for complicity in abuses in nations like Burma and Indonesia. Praising the court majority, Rick Hertz, an attorney with Earth Rights International, asserted, "We are going to continue to seek to hold the abusers and the corporations that assist them accountable." In the majority decision, Justice David Souter wrote that the Alien Tort Claims Act should be applied with judicial caution, but plaintiffs' lawyers say it covers clear violations of international standards such as torture, slavery, and genocide. In a sharply worded dissent, Justice Antonin Scalia decried the drift by the High Court towards endorsing a 20th-century invention of internationalist law professors and human rights advocates. Mother Jones magazine reports that the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law has failed to put a lid on the corporate-sponsored parties at this summer's Democratic and Republican conventions. Mining and energy interests are hosting a good old honky-tonk salute with barbecue and country music for Texas Congressman Joe Barton, who is chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Industry sponsors contributed $20,000 each to pay for the Manhattan Gala during the Republican convention. A $250,000 gift to GOP Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist's party provides 10 tickets to a VIP reception, plenty of extra tickets to the main reception, and access to Frist himself. His office says that proceeds will go to the senator's World of Hope Foundation that supports AIDS relief groups. Democrats heading for Boston in mid-July will also do their share of schmoozing. 8 political friends of Senator Ted Kennedy are kicking in $100,000 each for a private party by the Boston Pops conducted by John Williams. and retiring Louisiana Senator John Breaux will be on hand for the Mardi Gras party with music by Ziggy Marley and Buckwheat Zydeco. As Republican fundraiser Brandon Winfrey, who was organizing a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert in honor of Republican Senators Lindsey Graham and Saxby Chambliss, summed up, convention goers are going to have fun. They are going to want to thank somebody, and who are they going to be thankful to? The sponsors. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The U.S. handing over power to a newly appointed interim Iraqi government on June 28th has had no discernible effect on the violence that continues to grip the nation. A succession of car bombings, ambushes, and kidnapping of private contractors and U.S. soldiers signifies Iraqi insurgents' rejection of a transition process that the Bush administration maintains will lead to national elections and full sovereignty in early 2005. U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer left Iraq immediately following a secret ceremony where power was symbolically transferred to the new government, but not before he put in place a series of decrees that locks Iraq into privatizing some of the nation's key public industries and pushes the economy towards free trade and low tax policies favored by Washington. Meanwhile, an investigation continues into alleged bribes paid by Saddam Hussein to UN officials that allowed him to divert $5 billion from the UN-run Oil for Food program to his personal bank accounts. But new questions are also being raised by the humanitarian relief organization Christian Aid that says the U.S.-led coalition has not properly accounted for $20 billion of Iraq's oil revenue under their control. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dennis Halliday, a former Undersecretary General at the UN who administered Iraq's Oil for Food program before his resignation in protest of economic sanctions in 1998. Halliday examines the obstacles ahead for Baghdad's newly appointed interim government and the investigations into scandals involving Iraq's oil revenue.
I think we have to acknowledge that the so-called transfer or return of sovereignty to the people of Iraq is a sham. It obviously is not complete. The country is heavily occupied by some 160,000 overseas troops, the great majority of whom are American. The interim government, so-called, was not elected by the Iraqi people. It was selected by the United States of America with some assistance from the United Nations. And if you look at the background of the individuals, I think most of them have foreign passports and are expatriate Iraqis who came back in recent times. And the prime minister, as you know, has a CIA background. So this is not perhaps very encouraging to many Iraqis. However, I think some certainly will see this as a move in the right direction. It may be imperfect, but it's better than Mr. Bremer and the CPA running the country. And let's hope they will give them the chance, despite the weaknesses of this new arrangement, to get an election together in the next, 6 months or so, so that there will in fact be an elected government in the beginning of next year. And then they can then put together a new constitution, and then they can look at the edicts that Mr. Bremer issued upon his departure, which, you know, tie up the country hand and foot in terms of privatization, the foreign export of profits, various other arrangements, which I think are completely unacceptable to the great majority of Iraqis. So I think we have a very strange transfer. It's a beginning. Maybe it's in the right direction, but it's coming from an illegal occupation, an illegal invasion. It doesn't augur well, but let's keep our fingers crossed.
Well, Dennis Halliday, you bring up an important point. As Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator in Iraq, left, as you just said, he left behind a lot of orders, edicts, to secure the privatization of Iraqi industries, key industries. Detail some of those, if you would, for us.
Well, to me, privatization of Iraq under any circumstances, certainly present circumstances, constitutes rape. I mean, this is a country that's extremely vulnerable. In fact, it only has one large source of overseas revenue, and that is the oil industry. And this industry must be kept in the hands of the government. The revenue must be guaranteed to go into the needs of the people of Iraq. And that's particularly going to be electric power, and water systems and education and healthcare and employment and all the basic human rights that you and I and everybody else in North America takes for granted. I mean, those are the priorities. This cannot be privatized. And to privatize water, to privatize electric power, to privatize manufacturing, other aspects of the economy, I think would be quite extraordinary. And if this is to be done, it must be done only by an Iraqi elected National Assembly, which it looks like we will not see until this time or early next year. So Mr. Bremer's departure gift of edicts is, to me, quite outrageous.
Moving to a different topic, Dennis Halliday, you had served as the UN administrator for Iraq's oil for food program until your resignation in 1998. Now we hear a lot about investigations into an alleged scandal about the monies that were allegedly funneled to various UN officials and others. But do give us your comment on the ongoing investigation at the United Nations into Saddam Hussein, his role in bribing UN officials in the midst of that program.
I think there are a number of different scandals here which we need to address. I mean, the greatest scandal of all is 12 years of sanctions, which killed over a million Iraqis, particularly Iraqi children. At the same time, when we allowed the Iraqis to export oil, 30% of the revenue was then taken by the United Nations and given to Kuwait. At the same time, Iraqi children were dying because we did not have the money to rebuild the power systems and the water systems, which would have kept them alive. The next scandal is, of course, the invasion by Mr. Bush just recently, the beginning of last year, and then the occupation. I mean, these are the scandals I think we have to deal with. But you're right. There's talk in Washington, and it's coming out of Mr. Chalabi in Baghdad, that there's another scandal. That's the scandal whereby, under the oil food program, Saddam Hussein in Baghdad was able to smuggle some $6 or $7 billion worth of oil or oil products out of Iraq, and the revenue went into the Baghdad coffers or into overseas bank accounts or whatever. That, I believe, is correct and true, and that program was approved and overseen and monitored by the United States using satellite technology, and it was done by Washington in order to make the Kurds and the Jordanians happy, so to speak, or help them to survive, their economies to survive, under the sanctions placed on Iraq. The other aspects are closer to home, and that is the implication that some UN officials, perhaps in recent years, 2000, 2001, I'm not quite sure when the dates are, that they may have been offered the opportunity to lift oil, that is, to be an agent, in a sense, for oil, for the sale of oil, which would give them a certain percentage per barrel sold. Whether that happened or not, I have no idea. If a UN official did that, of course, it's completely incorrect and improper, and that needs to be looked at very thoroughly. The other scandals, which I think we're all aware of now, is the Christian Aid says that the CPA and Mr. Bremer has disappeared with $20 billion, hasn't accounted for that. And the scandals that go on, you know, with the Pentagon monies, well, we're talking hundreds of billions, I think, in that case. So we seem to be surrounded by scandals. They need to be all clarified. We'd all feel much better, I think, and I certainly would like to see the UN properly investigated and hopefully cleared.
That was Dennis Halliday, former Undersecretary General at the UN, who supervised Iraq's oil for food program until his resignation in 1998. In late June, a victory for the public, and especially for community media, was handed down by a U.S. district court when it ruled the Federal Communications Commission had to come up with a new set of rules governing access to the public airwaves. At the forefront of this struggle was the Prometheus Radio Project, a Philadelphia-based group that supports low-power FM broadcasting and media democracy. In June of 2003, the FCC ignored 3 million comments sent in by people opposed to the agency's proposal to deregulate big media corporations that would have permitted unprecedented industry consolidation. The public's response to the FCC measure was by far the largest ever on proposed rule changes by any governmental body. Prometheus was the lead plaintiff, joined by other groups, in a lawsuit against the FCC that was filed a year ago. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Hannah Sassaman, program director of the Prometheus Radio Project, about the danger the original FCC rule changes posed, not only by concentrating ownership within a medium like radio or television, but across all communications media. She also discusses a promising new development in Congress.
One of the rules that the FCC was putting forward was that there wouldn't be any problem with newspaper and broadcast cross-ownership, meaning that in one town, one company could own two radio stations, two TV stations, the newspaper, a bunch of billboards, concert venues, ticketing agencies, basically allowing major consolidation all across the United States. When this was happening, almost 3 million people wrote the FCC and said, no, this is not going to be good for our democracy or for our ability to have free speech or to have local competition in our markets made by people who actually live here. That was a big thing that was happening, and there were so many people all over the country from different sides of the spectrum. So this was a bipartisan coalition that, even though got 3 million comments into the FCC, the FCC ignored the almost 3 million comments that they heard saying no, so we sued them. And then people started to make oral arguments in front of the Third District Court of Appeals here in Philadelphia saying, yes, these rules that have been put forward are not going to serve the public interest, or they're not going to protect what people have been asking for from their media system. The FCC put forward arguments saying, well, we have a responsibility to just deregulate in the public interest. That's what we do. We throw away rules. And the broadcasters were saying the same thing. The judges determined that the FCC had not proven that they had served what they were supposed to do, serve the needs of the American public, when they established those rules. And so now they're back in the hands of the FCC to be restructured in a way that does serve the public interest. And it's going to be up to groups like us and other groups all over the country to make sure that the great public debate that's been happening over these past couple years about how media could be better, how more independent radio could flourish, how existing broadcasters could have real stringent obligations to their communities that actually made sure that people were getting diverse competitive viewpoints. They're going to be listening to us, listening to the voices of the people all across America when they make those rules. That's what we're going to be working on now.
Is the FCC going to appeal the decision?
We've heard from our lawyers that it is very unlikely that the FCC would be able to get a judicial appeal. There is really no case that can be made in the courts that this should be retried, mainly because the Third District Court of Appeals, when they looked at everyone's arguments, including ours, the citizen petitioners, the FCC's, and the big broadcasters, that there was no constitutional grounds for any of the arguments we were making. So it looks like probably what's going to happen is the FCC is just going to have to actually go back to the drawing board and redo these rules.
As of now, it's the same makeup on the commission, right? I know Commissioner Michael Powell is talking about stepping down.
What the panel looks like, what the commissioner's distribution looks like in the next few months is really going to depend a whole lot on the election in the fall. We definitely consider Commissioner Michael Copps to be one of the strongest fighters for what the public really needs in terms of a really good set of radio, TV stations, newspapers that are diverse and representative. He really thinks that that's important and really truly believes that it's the responsibility of the FCC to regulate in ways where people can really use the public airwaves to put across their own viewpoints and to hear lots of different viewpoints. Commissioner Michael Powell, on the other hand, has been quoted on record as saying that he considers the big businesses to be his clients rather than the American people.
Do you think the FCC could put out the same rules again?
It's very unlikely that they would be able to justify putting out the same rules as they tried to last June. The court did say that it's not completely insane that the FCC recommend that the ban between newspaper and broadcast cross-ownership, letting a newspaper and a TV station or a radio station be owned by the same company in a particular town, that's not totally ludicrous to them. What is crazy to them is that the FCC put forward such poorly researched and argued evidence that that was necessary. So that's back in the laps of the FCC. If they want a newspaper broadcast cross-ownership ban lifted, they'll have to prove that it serves the needs of the American public to lift that ban. What we really need to focus on is making sure that everyone across the country who cares about diversity of ownership in media and who also cares about getting locally owned independent stations where people can actually go in and broadcast their news and their ideas, making sure that those really proliferate. The one other thing that Prometheus is working on is expanding the low-power FM service. Senator John McCain just put on the table Senate Bill 2505. If that bill is passed, it will bring thousands more community radio stations, LPFM stations, to towns and cities all across America. So if you want a specific, concrete way to put your desire for local media into practice, call up your senators today and ask them to co-sponsor or support S-2505, which will expand the low-power FM service.
That was Hannah Sassaman of the Prometheus Radio Project. For more information, call area code 215-727-9620 or visit the group's website at www.prometheusradio.org. Since its release on June 27th, Michael Moore's newest movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, has broken all box office records for a documentary film. From the start, Fahrenheit, a sometimes humorous film that assembles an arsenal of facts to attack the Bush presidency on its post-9/11 and Iraq war policies, has attracted lots of media attention. In May, the Disney Corporation, citing the political nature of the film in a presidential election year, ordered its Miramax subsidiary to block distribution. Soon after, Fahrenheit won the Palme d'Or First Prize Award at France's prestigious Cannes Film Festival. Before the film was even released, Fahrenheit was being attacked by Republican politicians and some critics for what they claimed were gross inaccuracies and the promotion of conspiracy theories designed to help defeat George W. Bush in November's presidential election. But despite a campaign by groups attempting to keep the film out of theaters and a complaint lodged with the Federal Elections Commission to limit the movie's advertising, Fahrenheit has packed movie houses across America. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Rendell, senior analyst with the Media Watch Group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who takes a look at the phenomenal success of Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 and why many Americans are desperately seeking answers to how and why America launched an increasingly unpopular war on Iraq.
It's just amazing to see the media onslaught. You know, FAIR stands for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. I'm not going to say that we've done fact-checking on this movie because we haven't, but I am familiar with a number of facts that have to do with the movie. I don't know of any glaring outright errors. And what's more important, I guess what I bring to this discussion is that I've seen a lot of the media coverage of the film. Take, for instance, Lisa Myers at NBC, MSNBC. Her reports appear all over the place. She appears on NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw. She did a piece in which she actually suggested that Fahrenheit 9/11 wasn't even a documentary because she'd consulted a dictionary, and the dictionary said that documentaries had to be factual and objective. Then she went on with her report. She didn't question any of Michael Moore's facts, but she did go on to take some issue with some of Michael Moore's opinions. But I guess the main thing here is just the hysteria over allegations that there may be a couple of misleading things in this movie. And this from a news media that really went in the tank for the White House, the current White House, going up to the war, didn't ask probing questions. Now a documentary's out about the whole issue, and now the questions are coming hot and heavy. Mike Isikoff at Newsweek magazine attacked the film, and he said that Michael Moore and one of the people he interviews on camera, Craig Unger, said that the Saudis were able to leave without any interviews. This was published in Newsweek magazine with millions of readers, and it was false. Indeed, Michael Moore says they were allowed to go with very brief interviews, and Craig Unger says, besides brief interviews, there was nothing else. Michael Moore says, and Unger goes, nothing. So they'd allowed that there were some brief interviews. Here's a news media that we should point out. They not only have spent a lot of time covering for the White House, now what we're looking at is the news media covering for themselves. Here they were in the tank for the White House, really buying every one of the pretenses for war with very little scrutiny. They did not provide a real debate for the people, and their credibility is on the line. And I think this was pointed out several times by Michael Moore in some of the promotion of this movie. For instance, when he was on in an interview with Matt Lauer of NBC's Dateline. And Lauer kept pressing Moore with questions, and that's as it should be. And Moore finally said, gee, Mike, you know, imagine if you had asked this type of questions of the White House in the run-up to the war. We wouldn't be in the position we're in now. I think First of all, we have an establishment press that is almost like a palace court press a lot of the time. So it's defending the government to some degree. But in this case right now, some of the over-exuberance on the part of some of these reporters to try to find fault with this movie, I think has to do with they are targeted in the movie. And so I think that they're a little bit upset about it.
Steve Rundell, it seems that moves by the Disney Corporation, Michael Eisner's decision to block the Miramax company's distribution of Fahrenheit 9/11, plus the right-wing Republican organizations campaigning to stop theaters from showing the film has really backfired, given that it has just increased the attention paid to the movie, as well as I think there's maybe a sense on the part of ordinary people that this is an important movie to see if the powers that be, the movers and shakers, don't want us to see it.
I think this was going to be a big movie no matter what, but I think you're right. I think the attacks on its credibility, the group that's led by David Bossi, they're trying to stop the film from being able to advertise. They're claiming any advertisement for the movie should be seen as a political advertisement and therefore be subject to campaign finance laws. Some are trying to go to theaters and telling them not to show it. Yes, it is stirring up more heat, more buzz, more interest for people, but also I think it's they're telegraphing that this movie is considered very dangerous.
I think that one of the central strengths of the Fahrenheit 9/11 movie, for the first time in one place in a two-hour sitting, you can see introduced fact after fact, engaging an audience in thinking about the political machinations of this White House in moving from the September 11th attacks to war in Iraq, and really providing some context for those decisions that have not been provided by the corporate news media by and large since September 11th and since the war in Iraq was launched. So people are hungry for this information, and Michael Moore certainly has a spin on it, but people want to get this information that they can't get elsewhere.
I think you make a good point, Scott, that he raises a lot of issues. I mean, these are questions that should be raised every day in our national media, and they would be if left-of-center voices, if progressive voices were regularly included in the debate. But that's not what we see. What we generally see is a debate between the center and the right. And so a lot of what Michael Moore is doing for us with this movie is filling in a very short amount of time, filling in a lot of blanks that were left by the mainstream media.
That was Steve Rendell, senior analyst with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Call FAIR at area code 212-633-6700 or visit their website at www.fair.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Elaine Osowski, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.